This podcast is in partnership with Design Biennale Rotterdam, Phoenix Museum, Lack of Guidance, Margreet Olsthoorn, New Institute and Rotterdam Partners, as they all share the common goal to create awareness, share opinions and empower creative growth.
Every night I come home, I lay on the couch, watch television, but I want more. And then she said, why not? If you feel that, we do that. I always felt confident about my funding, so I don't know why, although when I look back, I know that I made many mistakes. So all these little steps made that we could survive, but we were on the edge of not surviving. Yeah, so you can think. That is stress, you know, when you cannot think.
Today, I'm joined by Pieter Oudolf, a visionary garden designer whose work has transformed how we experience landscapes. Known for projects like Highline in New York and Lurie Garden in Chicago, Pieter spent decades redefining the relationship between plants, spaces and emotion. In this episode, we dive into his early challenges and creative breakthroughs. He shares how taking risks shaped his craftsmanship and career and what the vital role is of intuition in great design. Good day, Piet. Thank you for joining the podcast. Can you describe where you are today?
So I'm sitting in the office. You know, the office is occupied by only me. And normally my wife helps me in more other questions, but this is where I work. We don't have anyone working for us. We collaborate a lot, but that might be not the question for now. But I'm here in the office and just ready for the conversation.
How is life treating you at the moment?
Yeah, very well. I'm just not much stress. In fact, I just finished a few big designs and I'm in the middle of starting again on others. And only recent years that I can take these little breaks and just not think about life, but how you say, feeling lazy.
Has that ever happened before?
Not much. Everything, I sit down and think what I'm going to do and feel guilty not doing anything. Then I have to tell myself it's normal, you know. If you look around, you're not the only one that's doing nothing.
A couple of years ago, you closed your famous garden in Hummelo, and now you're almost 80 years old, and there's a different time now. You don't have to do much towards people who come visit you, so you have some more time to do other stuff. Would you say that this is a fifth season for you?
The garden is closed for 10 years already, and I think we closed the nursery even longer ago. And I think the garden is closed maybe not 10 years, I think the nursery at least. But what happens is that, yeah, I can't talk about a fifth season because the garden was run by Anya, and all the PR and all the you know, the messages and telephone calls were taken by Anya and ruled by Anya. And if I was at home, then I could just say hello to, or some people I stayed at home because there were colleagues from abroad that came to see the garden. So in fact, yeah, stress is not related by opening or not opening the garden. And I think feeling relieved or relaxed has nothing to do with the garden being closed. Even when it was open, there was not stress.
Where do you think it did came from?
I'm quite serious about my work. And I think most stress that I had came from work related. But that sense, there were moments when it's just, you want to get it right. And it's not always, I think you cannot always just rule everything you imagined. Even if you work together with other people, you cannot rule their sort of way of working. And I think I'm a controller in a way. I want to see things going right and feel frustrated and it doesn't go right. And I think all these little things, more people will recognize that. You know, the moment you work together with other people and for clients, that is a relationship, I think, not only with yourself and family, but with a bigger risk and a bigger responsibility.
Do you also have habits or techniques to help yourself lower the stress?
No. I think I'm back, you know, the normal sort of peace or phase or something comes back after a few days. It depends if you work on a project that takes years, then the stress comes and goes, you know, that. By the moment you have to take action, you see that things go wrong or, there's a certain stress. And I think, especially when you work on a distance, when you work from here and over the ocean, and you rely on other people that carry out your design. Of course, you work like here with Zoom or with FaceTime and also with going back and forward with pictures or illustrations. That can be stressful because you cannot, even if you tell them what you think could be done better, that's some more one-on-one thing. So some things you can show them on distance, you know, say, oh, I should do that a little bit different, or the band is not curving right, you know, all those kind of things you could see nowadays because we have this sort of videos and see everything that other people do. But you sometimes miss the depth and the perspective and, you know, and the scale of where things are happening. Yeah, but the tune sound, if I have only stress, you know what I mean? I don't need therapy. I don't need a teacher to get off my stress. That's what I want to say. My wife, Anya, teaches me all the time.
I also read that she basically was the backbone.
I couldn't have done it without. No, because he always, I like to work solitude, more on my own, and I want to stay away as much as possible for people I don't know. And I think that you might have noticed that a little bit. But she took over all this task, you know, by taking up the telephone, talking to people. Okay, if you want to say something to Pete, just send an email, he will reply. But in the beginning, she was more seriously important because she had all the relationships with either magazines or clients and also the nurseries. When we had the nursery, that she organized these open days we had, you know, where hundreds and thousands of people came. And I think she called all those people. So, yeah, I couldn't have done this and sitting here when she was not there. So I think people forget that sometimes. I might be the sort of face, huh? There's a face behind the face.
In the interviews that are now from the past 10 years, where everyone's talking about your projects, there's not so much about Anya, but I love the book that you produced with Noel about Humlo. And there it's described very well. But what I also noticed is way back before someone actually knew abroad about you is basically the moment that you started. And there, for me, are two phases which I find quite interesting to dive into, if you agree. And this is basically the period from 16 till 30 and from 30 till 50. Because for me, this is basically really where you pushed your own boundaries without any expectations from the outside world as much as we know it right now. And what I would love to hear from you is how this first period, for instance, started. Because if I'm correct, at 16, you left home.
Yeah, long time ago. The relation with my father was not that good. I grew up in a, you know, in a bar restaurant in Bloemendaal. And I think that's where we worked with my brother on the, you know, I was bartender and just surfacing on after school time. I was surfing on the terrace and that's how it all started. But but there was a moment that, and then I just decided, I don't know why, but I thought, okay, I go and sailing on a bed ship, you know, and I think that, yeah, that was for a year and a half. So I was sort of officers servants, and I think I learned a lot about life, because when you're 16 and you start sailing and all these people around you on a small ship, I'm now going to small harbors, Mediterranean mainly. So I've seen a lot of, let's say, from Israel to Poland to, you know, the north of Sweden. So that was for 1.5 years, and I think it was a memorable time for me, because there was all this little things. Looking back, I felt that I really was a boy, you know, very ignorant. I noticed that when you went sailing, you see how the role really works. And I was, in a way, when I was at home, I was still protected, you know, by my environment and by being independent in my parents' business. So that was sailing. And then I came back home. When I was 17, my mother was always encouraging me. So she was always supporting me in a way, also financially a little bit when I had no money. But I came back home. I was there for a while. My father died. And my father was 53 or so, and I died. And me and my brother took over the bar and restaurant. And Anya, I got married with Anya in the 70s. We married, and I was still working at home. We had a mini golf course there, and Anya was taking care of that. We had two children at that time, and I was working behind the bar. But when the years evolved, you know, it took over. When I was in my 20s, I suddenly started thinking, is this what I'm going to do for the rest of my life? And in the meantime, I had bought a little house in the city of Haarlem. I think I was renovating that, living there. And I think I need to go away from, you know, from this environment. It was not bad, you know, I was working with my brother. And I think my brother wanted to take it over. And I wanted to quit because it was still my modest property, so it was nothing to lose when I would left, when I was leaving the business. So I just stayed there. I just started to work for Anna Carlos then. It was my first job. I didn't really know whether I liked green or not, but I needed a job, and I thought outside is maybe an opportunity or possibility that I would like, because sitting inside an office, you know, I had no education, so who would take me? So land labor was the only thing they would hire me for. And I think that is, I started to work on a nursery in Heemstede Garden Center, for one of the first garden centers. And they asked me to work for Christmas sales. And I did that. And then they asked me to, I could work on the plant department, you know, to divide plants that they would sell to municipalities and so on. So I came in the plant business, and it was in the middle of the winter. So the only thing I saw was the inside of a shed. The plants were brought in, and we had to, you know, to defy them, had to cut them or to prepare them for new plantings in the fields. I didn't mind, you know, I thought it was nice. I was always active. Not that I bothered working, not at all. But then they asked me to work in a nursery after the, you know, in spring, because there was a lot to do on hoeing and cleaning. And I noticed that I suddenly started to ask myself, what is this? What is the name of this tree? And So I started to buy a book about trees and plants, and that got me interested. So I saw pictures of trees and shrubs that I started to order them through the garden center. And I had no garden because I was living in Haarlem, you know, in this new house, but I planted them at my mother's house. Because we had a garden, it was big enough. It was just a good outlet for me. I could buy plants, put them in the garden, maintain them. So I became slowly, but was just... accelerating at a certain time that I wanted to know more and more. So I bought more books and bought more of this, and I was working that nursery. That nursery, that was a place where we met garden contractors, people that maintained garden, but they bought plants there. So one of them I knew from a restaurant where I worked, you know, the bar. They came there for lunch. He asked me to, I could join him, you know, in this company, because the only one with a driver's license was leaving, and I had my driver's license. I could step in. That was a sort of turn into more a craft of gardening, you know, because he was a very good crafts person, and also the people that worked for him, he had a high standard of the working gardens. So I learned a lot, and that made that I just started to go back to school. I thought I'd go to the evening school and get my license, but there's something in my head that I thought I want to have that license so one day I can start for myself. That was for, I think, 2 years, and then I slept over to another contractor. 1 year, and I was doing pretty well. I understood, I learned quickly. I knew more of plants than them at that time. So I got my license, and before I got that, 1 month before I started for myself, I'd asked the person that I worked with, maybe it would be nice if we become partners. Oh yeah, that's in a sense asking that someone who is busy with 10 years and has a wife at home probably will think, So the answer was, after a few days, no, it's not going to happen. I said, okay, then I will leave next year, May. And that was, you know, next year, May. That was, I think I was 25, 26 or 27 when I started for myself. And I had no clients, but Anya was still working in a mini course. And in the meantime, I sold my one house, a small house, bought a bigger house. Because I had no clients, I could work on that house. I renovated that house. And that house came pretty good because I had so much time, you know. And suddenly one of my neighbors came to me. He worked for a company in Amsterdam that was just taking care of big houses and offices for keep up. I don't know how you call them, but he said, our client bought another house, one of the canals in Amsterdam, and it's right opposite the house on the Prince and Rock. We need to break through to the other garden, so we make one garden of it. And do you like to take the job? And I had nothing to do. I said, of course. And they gave me some money, so I got 10,000 guilders to start. The first thing I thought was buying a pickup. And that is how I started my own company. So from nothing, suddenly in one job, which took me months. And I was also maintaining gardens. So I had in Heemstede or in Adenhout. So I had a few clients that I could go to. And I maintained the garden for them. But then suddenly I just started to accumulate a little bit. I got a good name and I got some clients. So before I was moving to Hamelo, I had a good name and I got some magazines that published my work, and that was it. So, but I felt that I had to do more, and that was a feeling that built itself up. You know, I was doing well, had an income, I live in a nice neighborhood, had a beautiful house. it was a repetition of things, you know, that you go to, you had some clients, you come back to, you sometimes someone called for a new garden. And I suddenly, because I was the interest for plants became more and more. So I was you could talk about plants for me 24 hours a day. And I think that was not an obsession, but something that really kept me busy. And I think if we start a nursery, I could grow plants that I could use for garden going to build. And I think that is what I say, that future that is uncertain. Where do you move to? What do you leave behind? You have a wife and two children. But I didn't think about it. I was talking to Anya, right, that I had the idea. I said, I'm just, so every night I come home, I lay on the couch, watch television, but I want more. And then she said, why not? You know, that's the good thing of Anya. Always said, never said no. If you feel that, we do that. So we started to look around. I think we had 200,000 guilders at that time. I could sell my house for, I bought. We could have a mortgage of maybe 50,000 guilders, and that happened. So we bought the farmhouse. And I had a mortgage of 50,000 to live from the first 2 years. Came here in 1981, and I came here with someone who would become my partner. I met someone at Telepane evening for gardeners before, and he was sitting opposite of me, and he said, just came back from England. I was head gardener at one of the most famous gardens in England, Ray Dexter. And suddenly came up to me, I said, what do you think about becoming a partner with me? I'm going to move to the eastern part of the Netherlands. You know, I said, okay, we'll have a look. And so he said, yes. So suddenly I had a partner without even asking my wife. So I did all these things. I don't know why, but when you look back, you think that's a lot of risk. You know, you're taking the only thing that you remember is that you thought that's sort of very realistic and very workable. Looking back, you say, no, it was not realistic because so many people warned you and you didn't even hear it. So we went here, we renovated the farmhouse. I was more or less building the whole nursery and I had the beds. But the good thing of this partnership was that he knew a lot of people in the gardening world. And he was writing a garden column for the NRC newspaper. So we got the first clients and the first people from garden clubs. And so you see that the bad things can have the positive elements. Eh? And that's how it happens. After 2 years, we split up. And I think it was then Aya took over. She did already the communication, already had some open days where we invited other nurseries to come here and to sell their plants. And we had enough friends at that time that would help her.
How in the period that you were still pursuing your ambitions and your path, how did you motivate yourself to keep going, growing, although you didn't foresee which direction or result it would give?
No, there was no one way forward. We couldn't go back. No, there was no money. We had to lend some money. I had to sell a collection I had of toys. I had to borrow something. We got my mother died. I had 4,000 guilders. So all these little steps made that we could survive, but we were on the edge of not surviving. I had to buy out Ronke too, you know. Yeah, so you can think. That is stress, you know, when you cannot think. Not about guts. I think that's something, a lot of things you block, you know, that don't come into you. Of course, we met a lot of people because we went to a lot of meetings, conferences about plants and plants in perfect space. All this kind of meetings made that our world became bigger. Although the place where we lived was still small. We built gardens, we built examples of what we could do with plants, show borders, yeah? And nobody had done that. You know, the nurseries had just nursery beds and acting was commercially and most efficiently set up. And I think that we didn't do it. It was for me one big experiment, putting things together. In fact, I felt myself more recognized that I saw plants as a tool to express myself, you know, not as just plants, but using them was a way for me to show the beauty I could create. You know, plants were just the tool, although I loved the plant as an individual character. But when you see it as design, you also have to love them for not only the beautiful character, but how they work in a company, you know, and with other plants, so that they can stimulate the eye by being together on a stage where actors are playing. And that you need also the characters that don't really, you wouldn't like to see on their own. Plants were not only a sort of goal in my life, but also a way in my life to show what I could do. And when you think about in the early 80s about garden design, you know, there was only Mean Rose, was famous at that time. I came in, I was not really busy with design, but I was busy with how can I bring plants together in a way that they, you know, planting design, which was normally given to the English, you know, to the English upper class with their staff of gardeners. But I wanted to break out of that sort of traditional way of gardening. And through the people we met from wild gardening and from conferences and conversations, we started to think different about plants. We started to think not only about the beauty of flowers, we started with the beauty of transforming, you know, how a plant could transform into something else that was even more beautiful and necessary in the whole system of plant communities. In the beginning, I didn't see it as plant communities, but more as plant combinations that worked very well and also could contribute to the eye in a later stadium. And so there was very sort of visual, very, very one-dimensional vision in a four-dimensional field. Over the years, that came into that you learned that it was interesting not only for yourself, but also for insects and wildlife, or wildlife you didn't want, like mice and moles. But, you know, you had things to enjoy. And that more than just the period of the flower. But that was how it transformed from just one-dimensional into also your vision became more four-dimensional.
How much did you transform as a person?
I've always been very focused, so I lose myself and in my well. And I think, of course, but also on the other hand, I'm very, very, I think a lot about other people. I wouldn't say that, but I'm very sensitive for what happens around me. And if someone doesn't feel happy, I feel that, you know.
You mentioned I don't go so far as I want to be able to dissect the plant fully, but I do need to recognize it and know what it does. By knowing what it does from a small plant to a mature one. The question that I had was, how well do you know yourself?
Yeah, I know myself a little bit. You know, I'm complicated, so that's what I know of myself. And that's enough to know yourself, I think.
I read that you called yourself quite stubborn. I more had the feeling that you're so ambitious that you know exactly what you want and that you pursue it, because it was in the context that a client wanted to have A and you said it should be B and eventually became B, but the client said it was a little bit pushed so much that it was beat away.
Don't take that so serious, but because that's an interview and an interview is not one-to-one, you know, and I think they call me for what I know, you know, not, and they call me for what they like for me. But if it comes to what will work in a garden, then I know better than them what will work. You know, if they want something in an area, and let's say they like particular plants, and I don't see the plant in the system of his garden, that I just tell them that I can't do that. And it was not stubborn, that's just being honest.
That's why I wanted to bring it up, because I can also imagine a lot of people who have the talent but feel that someone else is telling them you shouldn't because it should be this, that their confidence flows away. But like you say, yeah, but you asked me for my talent. This is what I propose.
I can be very straightforward to clients too, you know. I think, okay, that wouldn't happen. So it comes out of me, and I have opinions at the time that I can change a day later. So I also tell them, and this is what I think now, but maybe I change my thoughts tomorrow, because I don't want to fix myself into the idea that everything I say is true. Now, for me, it's the truth of the moment. You can imagine after 45 years of doing this job that if you come to a client that probably like your work, he doesn't know how it works. That is a big difference. And I think that is what you try to do. So I listen very carefully, and I think I try to accommodate the client in the sense that what he likes, that I could emphasize that a little bit in my design. And I think, okay, you love that, so I'm also a little bit of a pleaser that I want to make him happy too, you know, as long as I'm happy. You know? But that is the borderline, you know. If I'm not happy, I can't do it. And in an interview, you read it different than what I mean. I can be very strong in my opinions, but, you know, it's more related to what I think I know about experience. You know, but mm-hmm.
Has it always been like this, that you always were quite straightforward in, also in the beginning years?
Face-to-face, it can be very straightforward, Not in emails or writing, because I don't like to be face-to-face. Say what you think, you know, and keep it open. You want to have the conversation.
Together with Anya, you're one team. How many times did Anya come in between as a mediator?
Nothing. Show, I mean, talk about it, say, what do you think about this, or what do you think about that? You know, it's more, I just show it to her, and she has a good taste. That is what I need.
How important is time for you?
Most important for, time is unlimited for everyone. And I think time is important, That's what you mean, that when you get older, time becomes more precious. And when in the past you worked 10 years on a project, it's hard to do that again. You are more thinking more about how much can I do within so much time. And because the work you do, you want to not only design, but you want to see it in real as well.
Did you have a mentor?
No.
How important was Henk Gerritsen for you?
He loved our work. That's how he came to us. From the beginning, we started to experiment with plants that we got from botanical gardens to see if there are any good plants as a product or as a garden plant. He saw our first catalog. In that catalog, there were plants that he had seen on his travels, in Europe and Eurasia and wherever he went to. I think so. He was curious because his garden was a wild garden, but he also he was not afraid of using plants, garden plants. So it was a mix of garden plants and wild plants and wild areas, wild spaces. So we came to talk, and especially when we started this open days, we had weekends that people were invited to come over here with their own nursery stalls. They could sell bulbs or plants or the work. And Henk was always there. So we had long conversations about plants, of course, and about what they did for him, and I listened to him. I didn't understand it really, but it was also Rob Leopold from the Kruidhoek. He has a very strong opinion, but they all had the idea that it was not just about wild plants, it was just about the sort of the whole environment of plants that could attract them. And I think that is what we talked about. And then when we probably know that we started in 1982, and between 1982 and the 90s, we got such a good name among nurseries, but also in England and the rest of Europe, that people came from all over places to see our nursery and plants. I traveled with Anya a lot to England, and we made a lot of friends in England that had nurseries, so we were a sort of hub. We brought in a lot of new plants to our nursery and for Hond, for Dutch growers, but we also traveled to Europe and introduced plants from other countries, other nurseries in Germany, Sweden, Denmark. So having all this sort of freshness for gardeners, we became very well known. And that is why at a certain point, the publisher, Terra, came to us and said, why don't you make a book about your plants, Pete? I said, I'm not a writer. And I was thinking about it because I thought, if you're not a writer, you cannot write. That's what I think. It's a profession. It's a skill. So I said, no, but if I make a book with Henk, we'll take pictures of plants and we can make a book. And that was very rare for a publisher to create a book about the nursery plants and with descriptions, like a big catalog. So he agreed that Henk could write a book, and Henk came up with the title. Was called Bean Plants, A New Generation of Garden Plant, which the publisher didn't like at all. The publisher thought, okay, dream plants, who will use that term dream plants? Nobody will do that. Today, it's a different matter, In that, I was quite rare, but we kept the title, and I think the book became a success, and was found in a bookshop, Architectura, by a Swedish scientist from the University of Alnarp in Sweden. And they brought it to our nursery and said, why don't we translate this book into Swedish? We're going to try that. So the book was translated into Swedish, and we were invited to the university to do a lecture with other people from England, and that was my first sort of public performance, presentation. I thought, they want me in Sweden to do a presentation while I never had talked to anybody. And the longer I said, now I have to think about it. And then I realized if I don't do it, I will never do it. so I have to do it. That is sort of the argument that I meant. Otherwise, it just stops here. That I think many of these things in my life was, if I don't do it, I will never do it. So I have to do it. It became a sort of credo. So I went there and it was quite a nice success. So, and also I met other people from cities, park directors. And one of these park directors that I met on a conference in Freising, Germany, a few years later. And he asked me to do a garden near a library in a small place near to Stockholm. Stefan Mattsson was park director, and he had a city of Enköping. Was a small town where he was director, but the town was already well known for all his plantings. And I contributed with a planting near the library. And that garden became a success in the sense it became an example for many Swedish cities how to create green in public space. So from all sides in Sweden, they traveled to that little town to see what was done there. So that was my first public space I did. Was my first. And then I did some offices in the Netherlands. And I think that was a start outside a private garden. Yeah, so that was a sort of start of that people became interested in me doing more than just private planting. So I was asked to by a friend in England to do a garden, John Cook, 1996. The birthplace of gardening is, of course, England. And inviting someone from Holland to do a garden was a sort of cursing. But it was accepted. You know, I had a lot of questions, a lot of articles. And I got people from England coming over from magazines. And they were writing about me. So, and most of them were even positive, although I wouldn't expect that. But there were also hardliners that really, okay, that guy from Hello with all those glasses. And Robert Lane Fox was one of these against me. So, but that got me a name in England. And then first show, Chelsea Flower Show 2000 with Arnie Maynard, got the Best of Show. Suddenly I got four or five commitments. And a few in England, Penstorp, Wisley, Skempston Hall. Rather big. And I was on my own, so I don't know how I did it. But I think the good thing is that everywhere I worked, there was a gardener. And at least there were people that were able to create the work or to create the design. And at that time, I was really also doing stuff to do the, you know, the infrastructure, so the master planning. That means that you also, as an architect, you know exactly what I mean. Not only the planting, but the total design. That's how it all started. So I became very famous.
You started in 1982 with several clients. In 1994, you had your first public garden in Utrecht. You mentioned basically that gardens shouldn't be seen by a few people, but by a lot in public space. When you were asked to do such a commission, was that kind of a relief?
At that time, I didn't realize that, but, you know, at that time, I was just a commission for people I knew. I knew people from the botanical garden, and I think that is part that you say yes, because you can trust them for what you do. They know what you do, and they can help you in what you do. So the first thing with a few thousand pounds is under the hood of people that know what you're doing. That gives you confidence. And then the second one that you do that, I always felt confident about my plantings at that time already. I always felt confident about my plantings. I don't know why, although when I look back, I know that I made many mistakes. Let's say when I did the garden in Sweden, after the first winter, I got a message what plants had died, you know, because of the superior winters there, and you didn't realize that. So the good thing is that people understand plantings. The ones that were died, and you replace them by other species that were hardier. So you learn a lot. And I think that is step by step. It's not that you are thrown in a deep pool without being able to swim. No, you go from kinderwatchen now there.
In Sweden, it was realized and it was open to the public, and a lot of praise came from it. And you started to be more well-known worldwide. But for me, it was more interesting to read and hear also from you now that at a certain moment you got the call like, okay, but now some of the plants have died. What did it do with you that you at a certain moment saw like, oh, maybe it's not so well done? How important is failure for you, and how did you at that moment deal with it?
Every year, 5% of the plants died. So you have to calculate that in. So it's unexpected when you plant too late in the winter and that you have a wet winter, but there's a higher percentage of plants that die, even whether they are bone hardy. But you learn to do it to extend your planting time to spring. But it's not always possible in, you know, because there's a timeline in every project. I never felt as a failure, you know, in my career.
No, it maybe failure is not the right word, but it's maybe, and I should pronounce it better for everyone who's listening, that it's not about a failure, but more about a challenge coming up which you didn't expect and you want to deal with it. How did you always deal with the challenges? Was it always just push?
It's more belief, you know, that's what it is. It's not that in the back of your mind is, okay, I do it, but I know already that it's going to fail, you know, partly, because if you do that, you won't do that. You have to believe in what you do. You have to believe in the plants you use. Although over all these years, you know more and more about the plants. You know more and more about the situation where they are in and what they like and not like. The plant palette shrinks over the year, and you want to be more clear for yourself and that what you do will work. Of course, it's after every winter, something that probably did not do so well. Yeah? Although you have the experience with the same plant in another place where it works well. So it's not about the plant, it's also about the place, specific corner, specific soil. And you cannot just get it all. You have the experience that you now more or less know this is. These plants I can easily use. Other plants, I'm going to do it again, but I tell them that it can go wrong. So I give them the message. That's what I do. But there's no garden that went 100% right. And that's it. So after it's done, there's always something you have to redo, or it's very little. And I work with people together now. You know, it's not that I have to show up myself all the time. I work with Delta Forum Group for new threats. A landscape architectural office. I work with people from my network that help me out. But of course, I have the responsibility at the end. But I never feel that so much. My plantings, you don't feel as a responsibility. I feel as a responsibility that you bring in 30, 40,000 plants. People are working there. The garden is cost $1 million, you know. And suddenly we stand there and you think, oh, that's what I do now. So, you know, that's my responsibility. But normally you never feel that, you know, but I think I had a private project, quite big. And the moment it becomes private, there's a higher responsibility because the client doesn't know about anything. He probably asks you questions. He's saying, okay, I don't like this. And I think, you know, all these things that make you more aware of your responsibility. Well, the high line where you work with hundreds of thousands of plants, all the people you work with are plant people, park people. Things go wrong, they come back to you, Pete, what can we do? There's no, they don't make you responsible, you know, but a private person make you responsible. And that I realized later, you know, that what did I do? You know, it worked out good, you know, all the time till now. Oh God, if that had gone wrong, if, you know, especially with Corona, we planted 450 trees and swept just before it. And then we had to do another 100 shrubs a year after, and the Corona came in. So that feels as a responsibility. What will the client say if there's 100 trees at nurseries that have to come in, have to be paid or are paid?
How important is communication for you? And how did you learn to communicate these things with clients?
Clients with, let's say, in public space, you know, the communication is the client is the city, or the client is the gardener, or the client is a group of people. And communication goes often through Delta Forum Group, with the architects, with me, in Zoom calls. The communication is more mutual than just one-to-one. Only I have some good private clients. I still call some now and then, because then you feel more, and the private clients I have, they have we have a good sort of vibration. You feel free to talk, and you don't talk about wall of money that wants you to make it cheaper. Huh? Those all people that love plants, public space, and that's different.
In many public parks, every season, people or cities buy plants to update their planting again for the next season because all the plants died. And what you do is actually make a collection of flowers which keeps on growing season after season, and it saves a lot of investment.
So most cities do annuals and biannuals to fill up their borders. You know, it's more show gardens for one season. I think that was a lot of money. You know, perennial gardens or also they're more durable, more long-lived. course, save money because you don't have to dig them out every year and you don't have to replant. So that is the difference between two different kinds of approaches, you know, of gardens. Go to London, there's a lot of this sort of circular roundabouts full of annuals. And what I do is more complicated because, you know, your things are not maintained very well or not booked up very well. They still die, although they don't have to die, or the weeds come through, or it is neglected. So you have to take it out. And then, yeah, that's something that is not in my hands. The gardens that I do or design have to be taken care of in a way that with people that really know their plants. So, and there's not many people that know their plants. So that's why my market, if you can call it the market, is a niche, is something very small over the world. And that's probably why some people try it and won't work. And it's an organization that really knows what I'm doing, and with the staff of head gardeners that really know their plants. And that happens on the Highland, the Louis Garden, Vinderhof in the Netherlands, nowadays at Voorlinden, at Singer. Sometimes it needs a lot of persuasion to the client to say that if you don't have a good team of gardeners, it will fail. So you spend your money on nothing.
Are you more rational or emotional?
Both.
Practical or romantic?
Both.
Structure or color?
Both.
Control the narrative or let the garden tell its own story?
A little bit of both.
Cherish the process or cherish the result?
Result and process.
Your work primarily recognized for its ecological impact or its aesthetic beauty?
Both.
Design one final groundbreaking garden or curate and refine all your previous works?
I would like to have a new project. And I think the gardens that don't work well or refine my own gardens will take a lifetime again to get them where they were. Because gardeners have their own life and also they need to have their own life to change the right way.
For the legacy, the gardens will be taking care of the gardeners. And is there a wish from you that it's maintained the same way or just let it go?
Let it grow into the future, I always say. So let it grow by the good hands of gardeners and into something that still is good and especially beautiful. Because you can imagine when trees grow up that the plants underneath won't like it after 10 years. So you have to change your plants. And if I look back to all the plants of what I've done, no garden looks the same anymore. And you can just rip it out and put it all over from your original design. So that's it.
Focus on mentoring young designers or document your life's work?
Both.
Your gardens endure through maintenance or wild and natural growth?
Wild and natural growth doesn't exist because then your garden ends up in nettles and brambles. So it's always gardens are gardens, and gardens, I'll say, is a place where you feel good in there, and it's excluded from nature, the place for yourself. So you have to treat it, you know, like you treat yourself in the best way. So environmentally right, ecologically right, and just wildlife allowed. I see that in that sense. So it's not, gardening is about control. You cannot let it go.
Are you a mentor to others?
Yeah, I think I am. I'm a sharing person. I've never made a secret of my craft and my talents. Ask me and I tell you about it.
I read about this, that you are quite an open book about the techniques that you use, your craftsmanship. But basically you tell everyone you can use whatever I'm offering, but you probably won't reach the same result.
No, yeah, you know, if you read interviews, you read half of, you always miss the context. Huh? But for me, it's, can you say it again? Sorry.
The question was basically that you're an open book about your techniques and your craftsmanship, your approach, and that everyone can use it. But when they try, you doubt if they actually will reach the same outcome as they hoped or that you actually do.
No, they won't. So depend on the place where you do things. It's always a fraction different, a different plant here, a different composition, smaller, bigger. There's so much detail in the work, which you don't see that it looks easy. It's more complicated than one thinks. And I have people that really can make good gardens with the ideas of that I have learned for me in that sense. But I think that is, I think copying is a compliment in one way. Huh? I don't see it as something that's when like I think, okay, well done. You know?
Do you see in the generations younger than you some people that you could or want to see as proteges, or is it for you like this is Piet Oudolf's work? When I'm not here anymore, there's no need to pass on the techniques, the approach, or whatsoever.
No, because it's a lifelong experience, so you cannot. What you, a lot of people must have learned from what you do and what they did themselves. I know people that are busy for 20 years or longer, even with the same ideas that I have. You know, learned from me. I took them with jobs, and they joined me on jobs. They helped me on jobs. And looked at my drawings, they learned from whatever I did, and they do it themselves now, you know, in their own way. And I could say, okay, that looks like Piet Oudolf and or looks like his phantoms, but it's still what they do, you know, and it's good. And good is good. I'm not the only one that makes things that look beautiful, you know. And what I say, my work is ephemeral, huh? So whatever you do with it, it will disappear. And it's good that other people take it over in a way that probably are not really the same, but that they carry the thoughts.
What motivates you to share so much information with, for instance, students and colleagues?
That comes from inside out. I like to do that, not by that they say, oh, look how good he is. No, I like to communicate my emotion, my frustration, the beauty I see in what I do. Yeah, if you don't talk about it, you know, talking about it is also that gives you a sort of energy. Sharing gives you energy too.
Koen Jansen once mentioned that you have an outspoken talent for publicity. It's in the book Hummelo. It's a quote.
Yeah.
But there's a but he is not selfish. I was wondering, how much do you like Instagram?
I think my children know me much well. They know that I'm a person that's very sort of in the time you live in. Yeah. I keep track on a lot of things that other people wouldn't think of. Social media and, you know, modern arts, all these things. And I think that. But Koen says about publicity, I think Anja always called the magazines and she did all the publicity. So, and we initiated so much that it got publicity by what we did, not by calling people. And so it was just new in the pub world. So I think innovating also attract publicity. And I think that's part of what we did, whether we went to America to work in Chicago or in New York. Yeah, who doesn't want to write about that? So do I have a nose or do I have the skills that bring publicity?
When you entered the UK, you mentioned earlier that you got a lot of praise for your approach, but it was quite different from what they were used to, and that you also had some criticasters. How did you deal with the criticism?
I had a Financial Times had won a sort of they reviewed Gardens, so and okay, they were just totally didn't understand what I was doing, you know, and why people like my work. Yeah, I felt a little bit. Not even annoyed about it, you know. I think yeah, that's what it is. You know, they should ask someone else to write about gardens. Because if you don't believe in yourself, probably not get anything done, you know. I did start things that other people didn't do, you know. I say, if I had stayed in Fabric Gardens with my work, people wouldn't have seen my work as they see it now, you know. Going into public since the year 2000, sticking your neck out, you know, in project like the Serpentine, Venice Biennale, doing things you've never done before in places where millions of people come is a sort of risk. And if you don't feel that risk, that's what I never felt that risk. I just felt that I had to do that. I think and that creates its own sort of, stimulus for other people to look at you. It stimulates people too, that they want to see more and they want to do it themselves and they. Of course, I know I did it myself with Anja and in a world that was looking at me in public and sometimes they didn't like it. And most of the time they liked it. And if I look back in the beginning, then when I showed people my gardens or my friends, they said, yeah. And like, I would never do it myself, you know, that way. So especially my way I work with grasses and create a sort of more spontaneity in the garden where people were not used to. They were used to a sort of traditional English garden with all the dogmas and all the things you had to do. So to grow away from that, I needed people like Henk Gerdes and other people that have more from a wilder environment, from ecologically intentions than people from the garden world. Although they liked it, you know, but it's not, they liked it, but they couldn't take the step to do it. So what I did from the beginning was still looking good at the aesthetics and also the sort of depth that you want to see in gardens. And that's what, you know, to translate that as a sort of, that it becomes a sort of, that people start to see it and really in a way that they start to look different at plants than what they did in the beginning. That takes 20 years or a whole generation. So I think the generation of now, they really totally into what I do, you know, and what other people do in the field of mine, you know, sort of the naturalistic style, if you may call that. It's not my own words, but this is a style where we use ecologically-friendly plants, plants that live long, plants that attract people and wildlife and insects and so on, put together in a way that you feel like being in a natural environment, not in nature itself, but in a world that you feel like more loose and natural and seasonal. I think that is what needs a generation or more. And then people understand it because they see it from a different angle. But they see it from the world they live in and from an environment they live in. And together with the plants, and together with the idea of, we started with some people to do something different than just putting plants together because they look so nice. That makes the difference.
What do you want to do the coming years?
I still have a lot to do. I'm still working, of course. I go to Chicago next week, 10 days. We have 20 years of celebration of the garden there. Do a project in a black neighborhood. I'm in the middle of that. I'm doing a garden in, I have to go to New York in October for a celebration of 50 years Highline. I couldn't do that in the spring. So busy enough. I do a public space in Omaha, Nebraska. In the middle of that, we're still in the busy in the South Korea. That's also on the move. But what I said in the beginning, I'm very at ease now. But don't make me stop working because then I can't stop. And I finish the job, then I go on and on and on. And then I can be busy 7 days a week.
Do you have hobbies?
I can call this a hobby, huh? It's wide enough.
Do you have other things? Because jazz and blues, for instance, I saw was one that you like to listen to. Are there other elements?
No. Yes, I like jazz. I like blues, but I like hip hop. I like whatever, you know. I like whatever. No, I don't have a particular category. I like classic, you know. What do you like in classic? Opera? Now, don't give that a label because that's too far away from...
No, I know you don't like labels. That's what I found out.
I have a label already. It's that big logo sticking on me.
So how do you do it? How do you stay so fit? Because when I look at you, you're quite fit, healthy, and...
Do I sound fit to the conversation?
To me, well, I don't know you so well, but for,
For the interviewer, good or no?
Yes, and after 1.5 hours, yes.
Yeah, still, I'm fit. I'm looking, I would say. I still drink a glass of wine. I eat good. I just don't do much. I don't sport. I think all these things together make it work. And the good genes, probably. On top of that.
Thank you. That was my conversation with Pieter Oudolf. His journey reminds us that success doesn't come from following a fixed path. It comes from staying curious, taking risks and embracing the unknown as part of growth. Pete shared how he built a career without a mentor, how intuition and experimenting shaped his designs, and why true creativity is about seeing beauty in change, not resisting it. He reflected on the lessons learned from decades of trial and error, his dedication to craft, his openness to learning and sharing, and his refusal to compromise his vision offer valuable lessons for anyone navigating their own creative path.
If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to click the follow button, rate the podcast, subscribe to the newsletter and spread the word, so we can continue to grow the Don't Waste Eye podcast. And remember, everyone struggles, and that's okay, but standing still prevents you from growing and reaching your potential. Keep moving forward, because the better you become, the more you'll inspire others. Don't waste your time, don't waste your eye.